The intelligence world is a fascinating world, and we did have, in that Air Intelligence Organization at that time, we had a bloody good team, to the point where the Americans, working very closely with the USAF, they were our main source, of course. I mentioned the RAF earlier, but our main source was the USAF.
Yeah.
Where, on certain things, the USAF would ask us if we would take on a very narrow bit of, say, technical intelligence, and work it up. And they would do all the rest. And the point being that they knew that we had a very, very good team. But we couldn't do the waterfront, but we'd divvy up the work, so to speak. And we would home in on something and do it properly, as opposed to shotgunning the whole thing. Take that one aspect. And they would do all the rest. But it all came, of course, everything was made available to both sides.
Yeah.
So the Americans were always great that way. If you worked, when you were working with them, if you contributed something to a project.
Yeah.
If it was money, you contributed a dollar, and they contributed $100 million. You were a full partner, and therefore you got full benefit of the total project for your $1 ante. And the same when it came to the contribution of sheer brain power. DRB found this. Defense Research Board found this, and it worked beautifully. Jesus, it worked magnificently with the Americans. The DRB would home in on one particular thing in conjunction with the Americans, and where we had some very, very good expertise. But that being one segment of a whole. Now, the Americans would do all the rest, but again, everything that came out was made available to our DRB people for that relatively small contribution. So this was, we were always very conscious of this and always tried desperately to play our part, even though it was a small part. In some cases it was not insignificant, but it was still small in relation to the total effort.
Yeah.
But boy, we had the benefit of the total effort in the final analysis, and God, what a great relationship that was. So we were given information which was... Well, I don't know. I suppose one would have to look in the States and question whether they were legally right in letting us have that information. In other words, breaking their own secrecy laws. But on the other hand, they probably got away with it on the basis of partnership, that we were part of the team.
You know, one thing that I'm surprised at sometimes, do you consider the number of ministers of defense in the last 20 years, shall we say, you know, some of them just whirling around like you wouldn't believe, that more of them haven't accidentally come out with something that may not necessarily compromise us, but coming up with some information that he damn well shouldn't come up with?
Well, there could be a reason for that. While the ministers were briefed on what was going on, they tended to get more, what we were discussing earlier on, they tended more to get the intent brief rather than the source of the information or the raw intelligence as such. Because what they were interested in, and what we as staff officers were interested in making sure they got, was we have intelligence which says to us that here is what they will do. And that, again, as I say, the classification of that type of thing is nothing more than, well, you could call it top secret, secret, even confidential. They would realize that, well, even if they did say something, that it would perhaps be open to interpretation as to whether that was really the intent or not. We come back to that very point of interpreting the raw intelligence and trying to determine a course of action.
Again, you were there, at least in this particular time, you'd be there when Harkness was there.
Yes.
Do you have much to do with them at all, Rich, or not?
No.
Very little.
No, very little. Is it, it's funny that some ministers were you realize that the ministers would have an office on the Hill.
Yeah.
Up in their ministerial office,
parliamentary
office, if you call it, as well as an office down in D&D headquarters. Some of the ministers used to spend a lot of time in the D&D office, and not so much up on the hill. They tended to do all their work down in the Indies. Others, the complete reverse. They spent most of their time up in their parliamentary office, and little or no time down in their D&D office. And when they wanted something, the ministers who used their parliamentary office meant that the chiefs were constantly running back and forth up to the hill for meetings, briefings, what have you. Whereas those who used their D&D office, it was very convenient for the staff and excellent. Now, George Perks used the office, used his D&D office a lot. He seemed to use it more than his parliamentary office. Whereas James Richardson was a complete reverse. James Richardson never used his office unless it was some very special reason that he wanted to come down and see somebody or say hello to somebody. But that would be it. He would be in the office perhaps 5 or 10 minutes and then back up on the hill. And as a result, everybody who wanted the chiefs, or in this case the chief, would have to go up onto the hill. And briefings would have to be given up on his office. I think it depended on the minister and just how where he felt his workload was. Was it with his ministry or was it with his constituents?
I don't know. Interesting. But in any event, nobody evidently has boomed down, so we're okay there. Well, I think let's go into air transport. Okay. Reg, what do you think?
All right. Well, I mentioned that I was called in by Hugh Campbell, the chief, and given a hard time on something that I forgot, and then told that I was being transferred. That I was being transferred to Air Transport Command, and I would have to implement this air transport system that we had worked on so hard to cater to the Yukon that was coming into service in the 130s, which were already available, but to tie it all together into a system. So the headquarters, if I could go back to a little bit, one of the papers that I had to do when I was in plans was the location for Air Transport Command. At that time, Air Transport was still a group, I think. I don't think it had even been changed. It was 9 Transport Group, and it was at Rockcliffe, and in a tiny little setup there, and Rockcliffe was going to close. It was too small an airfield. It was very rapidly becoming a bind. Even North Stars had trouble getting in and out of the place. It was just no good, and the headquarters had to go. But where? And this was when Roy Slemon was chief, and I did a study that had two options. And again, it was during the time period when everyone was concerned about dispersal, the atomic attack and dispersal. So I did a study which recommended that we build a new airfield, a whole new airfield near Kingston, that would be in the heart of the triangle of Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto. Not too far away from all three, good communications, good railway, good road communications to all three directions. But the only snag with that was it meant building a whole new airfield. And it was going to cost about $125 million, as I recall, to put the runways in and the hangars. Well, the whole new airfield. And the second option was to move Training Command out of Trenton, where Training Command had been since year one, ensconced in Trenton. A lot of emotion attached with Training Command at Trenton, even down to the gates, the Commonwealth gates, which were presented by the Commonwealth countries to Canada for the effort, for the training, the wartime training plan, Commonwealth Air Training Plan. The gates were put in at Trenton because Trenton was a Training Command headquarters, and so on it goes back historically. And I wanted to move Training Command. My recommendation was to move Training Command out to Winnipeg, which is where the flying was taking place, and the flying was the most important part of the training anyway. The ground training could be handled easily, but it was that flying training that was important. It was all being done in the prison. Well, that one really hit the fan. It really hit the fan, because there was no way. Simon had a fit, because he had been, before coming in into headquarters, he had been the AOC of training, and felt very strongly about Trenton. Obviously, he couldn't accept the first recommendation, which was to build a whole new airfield, but he saw the logic of everything, and he just hated the thought of moving Training Command out of Trenton. He just couldn't face it.
Yeah.
And he sent it down to the AOC of Training Command, who at that time, who the hell was it? I can remember the thing going down with Sleman's signature saying, the study has been completed and I can see no alternative at the moment but to accept the recommendation. But before I make any moves, I would like to have your reaction, knowing full well what he was going to get. He, of course, in the damn letter arrived, and of course, his phone rang immediately, and yeah. I think he spent about an hour out here with the phone, with the earpiece away from his head. You could hear them shouting from Trenton what was wrong with it. And again, it was the old business. It was all the tradition and the emotion.
Yeah.
Trenton has always been Training Command. You don't do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You don't move a headquarters out of a facility where it has been for so long and it's all set up properly and it's working well. And we'd have to start all over again at out in Winnipeg. Yeah. And so
who wants to go to Winnipeg?
That's
anyway.
Right. Who wants to go to Winnipeg anyway? And so on it went. Well, the chief came back to me several times and said, I got to have another alternative. And every time I would come back to him and say, you don't have another alternative. And finally, Roy Sleman realized that he really didn't have another choice. That with the big transport fleet that was a building, that it had to be in Eastern Canada somewhere. And he looked at several alternatives himself. He even went out and walked the ground, so to speak, of bases, trying to save Training Command.
Yeah.
And of course, there was one other very cogent argument from a political point of view, which was that with the folding of Western Air Command, which used to be at Edmonton, and it did fold, we didn't have a headquarters west of Trenton in the Air Force. And it was about bloody time we had a full-blown headquarters out in Western Canada for political reasons. Well, of course, that one he immediately realized that the minister, who would in the final analysis have to give British John Henry on a plan to start shuffling headquarters around, would recognize too. So, well, again, to cut a long story short, Sleman finally, after months of heart-rending research, and accepted it.
Yeah.
And over the opposition of several of the Air Council too, who again, all dyed-in-the-wool people who've been in the Training Command, say you just don't move Training Command out of Trenton.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was decided to move. Well, God, the AOC of Training Command who went out to Winnipeg, he wouldn't talk to me. It took him about nearly 9 months before he would talk to me. He knew I was the one who'd the instigator and the planner and the one who'd done all this and made it stick, which was what really grabbed him. But that was how Training Command came to be at Trenton. And this was only a short time before. I was a second AOC of Transport Command at Trenton. My predecessor was Freddie Carpenter. And Freddie Carpenter had set up Training Command, Transport Command at Trenton as soon as the training people had moved out.
I
was the second one to go in there, into Trenton. And by that time, of course, also it had become a command. It was no longer a group, it was now a command, a full-blown command in the organization, command organization structure for the Air Force.
Carrying what rank?
Carrying Air Commodore. But it was obvious that we should have put it up to AVM. But it was, again, the old problem. Where do we get an AVM rank? We were so restricted in our rank structure that there was just... NATO had come into being, and so there was, and NORAD had come into being. And there was just no way that the chief could see to squeeze another AVM. So it was recognized that the rank would have to stay at Air Commodore.
Mm-hmm.
Even though... At the time I was there, the command was probably as big. It finally picked up all the reserves as well, all the air reserves, and had all sorts of bases. For example, Resolute Bay in the Arctic was an air transport command base. Goose Bay. And in strength, we wound up being an organization which was damn near as big as Air Defense Command, which had, of course, all the radar stations and the fighters and so forth. It was a hell of a big command. It probably wound up with roughly 12,000 people. So it warranted an AVM, but always bumped our head against the rank structure. Now, I had made a plea for that in my study, that it be an AVM, and that was the first time where I realized that we were kind of whistling Dixie, that it was very little chance of it ever getting up to AVM. Now, that was while I was a planner, and I had no idea I was going to be nominated to go down. So it had no direct effect on me.
Yeah.
it was just logical that the way the thing was coming together, that it required a higher rank.
Mm-hmm.
When I left the command, I tried to get it upgraded, but no. It was still the same problem. We just don't have an ABM position. And as a result, it never did get up to the ABM level. Right up all the way through until, through unification, until the cutbacks took place, and then the formation of Air Command, which is what we have at the moment, it is now a group. It's gone back down a group. And all this time, and it's still got an Air Commodore, a Brigadier General,
It's
still sort of the one-star level, has always been one-star level. Well, I arrived down at Trenton, and of course I was just delighted to be given the command, having done all that work on that study, and realizing that that the implementation of our plan was going to take a lot of hard work, and there was an awful lot between what was on a piece of paper and actually putting it into practice.
Yeah.
But I was again fortunate. One of the people who had worked on the study, there are two of them who had worked on this study, that terrible 6-week period, both were at Air Transport Command and on the staff. And so we had all, in other words, the rapport was there, and we all knew what we had been thinking.
Yeah.
Regardless of what was on the paper, we all knew what we had been thinking from a philosophical and conceptual point of view. So we started to put the whole thing together, and it went beautifully. The plan, it was one of those occasions where the plan had been well done, well thought through, and Ottawa gave us the resources, or at least most of the resources, we need to put the thing into effect. So it was not too difficult. It was just a question of gradually, we'll take the air movements units, of gradually training the people, getting them in, training the people that would become our air movements technicians,
mm-hmm.
setting up where the places, getting the works and bricks people to alter the buildings or locate the actual warehousing that they would require, buying the ground handling equipment that they would need to do their job. In the meantime, of course, the new airplanes are coming in all the time, such as the Yukon and the Cosmopolitan. The 130s were already in. So we had a lot going on. It was a very, very busy time. And lots of problems. Oh, lots of problems coming up all the time. Technical, operational problems, such as the Yukon. The Yukon had a Rolls-Royce engine in it. That was a development engine. We knew it was a development engine when we decided to go for it, but Rolls-Royce were very confident that it would come along very quickly and that we wouldn't have too much trouble with it. Well, as always, we were all very overly optimistic, and we had a lot of trouble with that bloody engine. It was supposed to last 400 hours. And then be yanked for an overhaul. In other words, the overhaul life was 400 hours, with the anticipation that very rapidly it would go up to 10,000 hours. But we're now in the development stage, and they wanted to pull them every 400 hours. I don't think in that first year to 18 months of operation that we had a bloody engine that was pulled at 400 hours. They were all pulled before 400 hours because they had gone unserviceable. And we were... At one period, I remember, we didn't have an engine that lasted more than 200 hours before it was unserviceable and had to be yanked. Well, it was a development, you see. It was a development engine, once we got the bugs all out, it was fine. The engine went like clockwork.
Yeah.
But God, here we had, again, a new airframe and a new engine, and again, lots of electronics, new electronics, and trying to make them all work together. And God, we worked hard. The number of times there were not just the engines, there were other airframe problems too. And the number of times I'd have the aeronautical engineers in the office with the damn drawings and say, now show me exactly what the problem is. And just trying to understand the damn problem. And then they'd show me the drawings and say, well, now it happens to be that particular bolt, or in this particular piece of equipment, here is the part that's causing the problem. And then they would explain the problem. And then we'd say, all right, what do we do? And, of course, always was that terrible thing, grounding the fleet. And I was the one who would have to make the decision to ground the fleet. In other words, there was a flight safety implication to this particular problem. And if it was great enough, then I had no choice but to say, I'm afraid we're going to have to ground the fleet. And then I would have to get on the phone and phone the chief and say, here's what's happened. And I must now ground the fleet. I can't let them go on. And you must know, and there'll have to be a press release, and I've got the PR people working with the PR people in Ottawa. All that kind of nonsense that goes on. So there was a very trying time in getting the all the equipment together, getting it to work properly, getting the people trained, and basically putting the system, this design, bringing it all to fruition. Well, the joy was, though, that it all came together. There was the design was right. It was a question of making the bits all work. And
were you doing any firing yourself at the
time? Yes. Yep. Not a lot. All those years I'd been in Ottawa, I had only been doing what we called a practice flying, which was casual flying, and I had lost green ticket status, which is instrument flying, rated instrument flying.
Yeah.
But soon after I got to Trenton, I got my green ticket back, so I was again a green ticket. But I found that as the airplanes, when we got up and started to get into the bigger airplanes, the Yukons and so forth, the Yukon was a very difficult airplane to fly. And the only way to fly the Yukon was to go through the whole conversion course and take the whole thing, which was a 6-month job. So, and there was no way I could do that, take the time. So I stuck to things like the Cosmopolitan and the 130, which were very forgiving airplanes. And therefore, when you were not flying 40 or 50 hours a month, then you could fly those things.
Yeah.
And we also had introduced another policy. We had lost several senior officers. As a matter of fact, we'd lost 2 AOCs of Transport Command and a staff officer from Ottawa, all Air Commodore rank, because they thought they were hotshot pilots when they weren't. They had simply lost their touch. They just weren't flying enough.
But when you say lost them, do you mean in air
crashes? Oh, they were killed. They were killed in air crashes. Oh, yes, they were killed in air crashes. And they were actually flying the airplane when the accidents occurred.
Yeah.
And although they had very capable people in the right-hand seat, they still managed to kill themselves and everybody else in the airplane as well. Two of those accidents occurred with Mitchell, which was a bad airplane, the Mitchell. It was a hot airplane, and it needed a current, somebody who was very current on that machine. It was an unforgiving airplane. And you had to fly it right in accordance with the book. And if you didn't, then you were in trouble. And once you were in trouble, this is where your lack of practice really took over. Even if you were fully up to speed in practice and gone through all the various emergency drills, one after another, constantly, you still had trouble with that airplane.
Right.
If you hadn't, then, of course, you were in trouble. And this is what happens.
Yeah.
But more often than not, losing an engine and then losing control of the airplane and overpowered on one side. No, don't go into it. So we introduced that in future, then any senior officer flying would always have to have somebody who was very current on the airplane with him.
Yeah.
Not just his executive assistant, who may be current on the lighter plane, but was not flying enough to be current on the bigger birds.
Yeah.
Just no way. It was just asking for trouble. So from there on, any time I did fly, the man in the right-hand seat had to be someone who was absolutely hot on that particular machine. So that if something did go wrong, instead of having a team of two who were both right up to speed and would handle the emergency without any nonsense at all, the one man basically could almost handle it himself.
Yeah.
Doing the work of two men. That's really what it boils down to. Because it was impossible for someone who was, unless you were flying all the time, to be ready to react without thinking. All the various types of emergencies that can happen in a cockpit. And when these emergencies happen, you've got to be able to just work without thinking. And I have been up on the flight deck. Fortunately, I was never in the left-hand seat when there was an emergency, but I have been on the flight deck when there had been on the one particular occasion when there was a major emergency. And it was just poetry in motion watching those two pilots, the captain and the other one, who they were all captain status. They were just captain of that particular flight.
Yeah.
And the other one was the first officer, and then the next leg they'd flip over. But they're both captain status. Just poetry in motion, watching those people operate without thinking, calmly, and the first thing you know, within 15 seconds the emergency was over. Just done beautifully. just you really had to see it to appreciate just how smooth it was and what a catastrophe it could have been if they hadn't done what they did in those few seconds. And it was, they do it so it happens. Yeah. Just like a bang. Just a bell. It's almost as if a bell goes and that's it. Oh, no, it's just true. No discussion, no yakking. And unless the emergency called for a coordinated action, then one would say, I'm doing this. They would say, fine. And then would pick it up when the time came. But there we have the value of the synthetic trainer.
Yeah.
And it was for the, I guess, the, no, I guess, well, she wasn't, the 104. No, I guess it would be the CF-100. When the first concept for using those sort of link trainer, but a very modern link trainer, came into being, I guess it was the CF-100 when we went to Treasury Board, and I remember it was going to cost over $1 million for that first one, and Treasury Board said, no bloody way, $1 million for a link trainer? You've got to be crazy. And it took us months of hard-nosed briefings on with facts to convince Treasury Board that a synthetic trainer was not only going to be more economical in the long run, but it was going to save lives.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a time. Months. But finally, they broke down begrudgingly, but at least the precedent was set. And from there on, every new airplane of any numbers that we were getting, or complex type of, then we always got trainers, such as for the 104. But the one for the Yukon was a particularly good one, and the value of it was that instead of hours and hours and hours up airborne, flying around the sky, boring holes, doing all these emergencies, you sat in those damn trainers, and you could do it over and over again and pick up the mistakes, the instructors, and show the pilots where they were going wrong. And they had to do this. They had to take a trainer check every, every 6 months, I think it was. Yes, every 6 months. They had to go into the trainer, although they were doing a lot of instrument training and practicing, but there was a test once every 6 months when they had to go into that buddy trainer and be put through a mill, and I mean a mill. I've seen lads come out of those, the captains, qualified, experienced captains come out of the thing wringing wet just from the strain of what they've been through, with one emergency being thrown on top of another one. But boy, the result was just superb when the actual emergency occurred. Yeah.
You can't teach that in a plane.
We used to have accidents. A lot of accidents were caused by something that we had no other way of doing, which was you're taking off in a twin-engine airplane. Yeah. And just as you're airborne, you lose an engine.
Yeah.
Now, what do you do? Here you are. You've just got flying speed, and you've lost all power on one side. Now, if you don't know what to do, you're going to crash. Well, what happened, of course, occasionally, just practicing that, we did have a crash. Something went wrong between the student and the instructor, and they weren't able to recover in time, and there was a bloody accident. Well, once we got the trainers, no longer was there a question of cutting engines in flight. No, just that was taboo. You never chopped an engine in flight from that time forward. You did it 1,000 times in the synthetic trainer, and the boy then went through all the actions that were required if he lost an engine, or two engines, as it happened with a four-engine airplane. Yeah. Then when it did happen in the air, he knew exactly what to do. And if something really seriously was wrong, then there would be a crash. But at least it was something that you had done all the training for and you couldn't avoid.
Yeah.
Not something that was brought on because somebody, as a part of our training plan, training procedures, chopped an engine to see what the student would do. Oh God, saved! I'm sure we've saved dozens of airplanes
by those millions
of dollars. I mean, of course, lives. That's the big thing, lives.
What was a Yukon like? Put on the coffee.
Yeah, the Yukon was a big, big airplane that was very difficult to fly. It had very difficult flight controls. And very few of our captains ever really did master the Yukon and being able to grease them, that word grease them, every time. Some of the landings were atrocious. I came back from one trip with a captain, and I got hold of it. As soon as I landed, I phoned our training people, and I said, I want that boy checked out. He bloody near wrote that airplane. We were damn lucky. It was full of the passengers, too. The landing was in Vancouver after flying from Trenton. I happened to be in the back. I was in the back. And my heart came right up into my mouth with the leapfrogging we did as we went down the runway. Well, that was... Oh, yes. Oh, Jesus. I thought we were going to stall on the second one. It was just terrible. And could slide back. It was that bad. It was that horrendous. Well, that was the kind of thing that could happen with a Yukon. It kind of got away from you.
Well, what happened about your four-engine,
yeah.
Rolls-Royce,
yeah.
That's not the one with the big flap letting down on the back.
Well, they all have big flaps letting down on the back.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they all do. Yeah. All those airplanes did. No, it was such that you came in, and if you came in a little slightest bit hot when you touched down, you're airborne again. And then you didn't know whether to go around to try and jockey it back down on the ground. And if you decided, you made the decision to bring it back down on the ground, and you misjudged again, this time you were really back up. And now you're in a stall condition. Yes. Oh, dear God. It was a terrible bird. Whereas with the 130, entirely different airplane. The 130...
What's the name of the 130? The
Hercules.
The Hercules.
Right. Yes, the Hercules. Beautiful machine. It just flat on the ground. You can come in a little bit hot or even closer to the stall. Didn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah.
It practically flew itself onto the ground.
Yeah.
Not the Yukon. It had sloppy controls. When on hold off, God, as the airfoil was beginning to fall away from the ailerons, it just seemed that there was just no control. It was sloppy. And then a wing would drop. And, oh, dear me, they were not a good airplane.
Oh, dear.
Not a good airplane. We were lucky that we didn't have any fatal accidents.
Yeah.
Because of the aerodynamics of the machine. We had some very near, we had one. Well, again, it shows you what training can do. We had one case of an aircraft had been on a long training flight, and it was coming back, trying to get into Trenton. And something happened with the fuel cocks. And as a result, the airplane very rapidly was going to run out of fuel. And the engineer on that one happened to be he'd done his homework and he'd been through the drill. And there was some minor little technique that was terribly important to do to get the fuel transferred in the right way.
Yeah.
And by God, this character did it. He had to practically tear the airplane apart, but he did it. And that airplane, by this time, was in real trouble. They got down, they landed at Ottawa, and as they landed at Ottawa, all four engines stopped on the airplane.
Oh.
On the runway, all four engines stopped. Now, they would have stopped a lot sooner if this flight engineer hadn't gone through this particular thing, which was only happened once. Only happened, a failure.
Yeah.
One failure. It happened once.
Yeah.
But that once would...